All right, so Security Zone Commission, this is the question we get all the time. Where's my deed? What happened? Are we in trouble? So this is what happened.
There we go.
Okay. This is good old-fashioned red tape. It's a not very satisfying answer, but it's the truth. And it is more rigid bureaucracy than incompetence. Nobody's looking for a bribe. Nobody's upset with the vines. There aren't any problems. It is really just really rigid bureaucracy, and it's taking time, and we're having to blow through it. So what we're going to be doing is cutting through all that. The Security Zone Commission, so you guys, everybody asked me, has anybody ever been approved? So here are the numbers on it. We have more than a quarter of the total files that have been presented over the last 7 years have been approved. No file has ever been denied. And anecdotally, I've never heard of any file ever being denied. They languish, they disappear, but they don't get denied. We have another 10% of our files that are in the final stages of being reviewed. There are several stages, and we get notices of when they're at different levels. Another, I think, 15 or 20 files or so are right there. I've had those files sit there for 3 months. I've had them sit there for 3 weeks. I've had them sit there for 6 months. I don't know what makes them come out faster than others. We push pretty hard on that, but we don't always know. So what we're doing is sort of blowing through this red tape. In particular, a year ago in July, we hired new notaries who have very direct contacts inside the Security Zone Commission. What was happening before is that we'd put files in. Just so you guys know, the filing that we do, honestly, looks like this. It's this big. Every single one of the things that we file has to be certified by a notary and presented in a very formally. Any mistake in any of that can stop the file from moving. Previously, there would be mistakes, or a notary wouldn't sign on the right page, or something would happen, and we just never heard. Silence, right? And in the regulatory world, silence is death. So what we have now are people who have contacts. When we don't hear on a file, we can pick up the phone, or our notaries can pick up the phone in front of us and call the guy on the inside and say, where is the file? What's going on? Oh, you need to update the background check. Because the other trick that we have here that ends up making these things take a lot of time is that we ask you guys for these background checks, these criminal background checks. They are supposed to respond to the filing within 90 days per the statute. We don't hear anything from them. And a year later, they say, we can't do anything until we get an updated background check, because it has to be within 6 months of when you filed it. Okay, so then we do that. And then we wait another 6 months, and they say it's out of date again. It's happened. I've had files where it's happened 3 or 4 times in a row. But so we're in good shape with that. And the other thing I did this time is I made our contract with our notaries performance-based. They don't get paid until they get a clearance. They get paid more for clearances that happen in less than 90 days, in less than 6 months, and less for more than a year. So everybody's interests are aligned here. So I really think that what we're going to do is see more approvals more quickly. I know we've been saying that a long time. And then the other, the most important thing is easy for me to say, and it sounds like I'm placating you, but don't worry. This is going to happen.
Good point.
Until we get to this. Go ahead and pull that stuff in. So in 2012, there was new legislation passed that added another hurdle. In addition to the Security Zone Commission, we've got the Ley de los Tierras Rurales. And this was a national legislation that's designed to control how much land is in the hands of foreigners. The law was passed in 2012. You can put it all up. They didn't actually open the office to accept any sort of action until February of 2013. When we went in and said, okay, so we have these documents, they said, we don't know you have to come back. The law's not, doesn't have the reglament, the reglamentos of the law aren't done. The office is barely opened. They don't know what they need to do just yet. Therefore, we don't know what we need to do just yet. The same notaries were very involved in getting the office up and running, and the same notaries are working directly with the heads of both the Security Zone Commission and the Registry of Tierras Rurales to try to create a connection between the two so that if you have your Security Zone clearance, that you get a shortcut, fast track on the registros, on the registros certificate that they need to issue. But what it means is for those of you post 2012 purchasers, you're going to have two things, not just one. As I said, the RNTR sort of puts us right back where we started. I don't know if you guys can read all this, but he says, I can't find the department for red tape. Can you give me directions, please? You must apply in triplicate, recycled paper, biodegradable ink.
So those of us that purchased before 2012,
you go through the first mess, not the second mess. Less mess for you. All right. So what we're doing on RNTR is pretty much the same thing, other than crying. We're complying. We're filing the certificates as soon as we get the security zone approvals, and we're lobbying. And this is one of the things I think we're doing most effectively is we've got the right people in the right places. They know about us. The most important thing is the kind of investment that each and every one of you have made is exactly the kind of investment that Argentina wants. You're not taking 30,000 hectares of prime land. You're really putting money back into the system. We're the largest employer in the Uco Valley right now. We have the governor of Mendoza. We have the mayor of Tunuyán. We have all of these people on our side, and they understand that what you guys are doing is bringing investment, long-term investment, to Argentina. It's not a quick turn type of situation. I talked to you guys about all that. But because I'm, go ahead.
That SCZ thing, is that federal or is it going to be more area specific?
The SZC, Security Zone Commission, is federal. RNTR, federal. But the RNTR, the register, is designed to control how much foreign land is owned in each individual province by foreigners and try to limit that to some extent. They're looking at, as Pablo said yesterday, they're looking at giant purchases, and they are looking at purchases of soybeans, purchases in Patagonia with lots of natural resources, those kinds of things. They shouldn't care about what we're doing, but the law is a very blunt instrument, not a scalpel. So it applies to us in the same way it applies to someone who's purchasing 30,000 hectares. But because I'm a skeptic, as you all know, we're working on another solution also. We're going to try, obviously, this is obvious, urban equals not rural equals not subject to the rural law. So what we're going to try to do is get our project designated urban, not rural. So you guys will own urban vineyards, so you have to dress very hip. And in that situation, everybody would just be immediately taken out of the necessity to comply with this law. We have the support of the mayor. We have the support of the minister of tourism. It's something that we may be able to get done, and I think it's probably not a bad thing for us. We need to analyze exactly what the ancillary effects will be, and we need to take a pretty hard look at. But it's not something that's going to happen tomorrow. So it's not an immediate solution. We'll keep pushing along, following the bureaucratic trail, but we think this may be a nice shortcut. So 2007 to 2011 purchasers, 6 to 12 months, says she hopefully. Part of the issue, so that you have an idea, there are 15 lawyers in the office that review each of these files like this. They are also responsible, and don't ask me why these are connected, it's Argentina, for reviewing every single application for licenses in the Department of Transportation for the entire country. They are also responsible for processing every single one of the security zone applications for the entire country. It's slow, and what they tell my notaries ask us, please, please, no, stop sending files. You're going to overwhelm them. So the 6 to 12 months is more a question of pacing and trying to get the right pace down so that we are putting in approximately 10 to 12 files a month. We're re-presenting most of the files that we've already presented with our new notary's name on it. We've re-presented more than 40%, more than 60%. We've got 40% to go. And we're just trying to get it out as quickly as possible. Post-January 2012, 12 to 18 months. Question?
Excuse me, on the SCC deed, you have multiple owners, is there only one name on that, or all the names, multiple owners have a name on that?
For every one of you, we file one of these. And while you're waiting, enjoy it. One of the important things I think here to understand is that it is not uncommon in Argentina to just never go get your final deed. The purchase contracts are considered the finalization of the commercial process. And you will see people building houses. You can ask Pablo about how they do it in their real estate developments. There are a lot of people who just sign the boleto de compraventa, which is the equivalent of a purchase contract, and then use and enjoy their property, because as soon as you do a deed, you got to pay taxes. And nobody in Argentina likes to pay taxes. But so there's also a little bit of a cultural issue. I think that both our notaries, the People's Security Zone Commission, they're like, why are you so freaked out about this? You're using the property. You've got possession. Why do you care? It's hard to wrap your brain around it. I mean, I'm still an uptight white lawyer, right? It makes it hard for me. But I really do think that's helpful to understand the context, too, of why nobody's really in a big hurry about this. I think that's it for Security Zone Commission. This is just a quick, I hear this every now and then. I haven't heard it from any of you, actually, about expropriation. This was back when the IPFA thing went down, and I think people have asked about it before. None of us think it's an issue. One of the guys that I use as a lobbyist is Gabriel Fidel, who was the former Minister of Tourism and the Economy for Mendoza, as well as our lawyers. They issued a statement for us. The IPFA thing was a very particular case with a very particular background. I assume everybody knows about this, that they went in and took over what was a private company. But there was an original contract with another company, Repsol, which is a Spanish company, and they were supposed to have done under this contract a whole bunch of things that they just didn't do. There's a lot of interest in the natural resources. We're talking about the natural resources of the country. Most of the public in Argentina was behind the nationalization of that. Of IPFA. They don't care about your 3-acre vineyard. Even if you put all of you together, there's no way the national government is going to come in and try to run your vineyards. And when you guys talk to, you know, Nathan this afternoon, I mean, as you guys know, making a lot of money on these vineyards is not something that's easy. They're not interested. It's not a question of national security. It's not a question of economics. But I do get this question, so I did want to just run through it. If anybody has any questions about it or wants to talk about it, I'm happy to. Great. Okay, I get a lot of questions about estate planning, generally. So this is just a quick thing. I think this is probably just as easy for y'all to look at on your own. In general, there are no inheritance taxes. Sometimes there is a stamp tax on the actual transfer of an asset. People ask me all the time who own properties as in groups, whether it is a tenancy in common or a joint tenancy. That's right, with right of survivorship. She's closer to law school than I am. In a tenancy in common, you own an undivided interest, and you own a percentage of an undivided interest. It's like one pie, and I own a percentage of the whole pie. And in those cases, when you die, that piece of the pie comes out and gets distributed among your heirs. Joint tenancy with right of survivorship, the pie stays together always. So you die and your interest dissolves into the interest of the other people. In Argentina, it's a TIC. It's a tenancy in common. So your piece of your pie goes with you. So then the question becomes, what law applies when I die? How does it happen? Normally in Argentina, the state of the dead person's domicile, where they live, is what applies, regardless of nationality, except for real property, which has to pass in accordance with Argentine laws. The big issue here then becomes forced heirs. In Argentina, if you have to leave some part of your estate to your kids. You cannot disinherit your children. A concept that's rare to us, at least here in the United States. If you're leaving your property to your kids and your wife, you don't really need to think about this. And I think that's where most people are, so it's really not that big a deal. If for some reason you want to exclude them, we need to talk about it. How to make sure that can happen. The easiest and most obvious way to do it is that there's 20% of any decedent's estate that can be freely transmitted, that doesn't have to go to the kids. I am pretty sure that in most of y'all's cases, your vineyard doesn't represent more than 20% of your estate. If it does, let's talk about it offline. But if it's less than 20%, that 20% you can leave to your grandmother's dog if you want to. And Argentina is not going to say anything about it. I think that's it for estate planning. Any questions about that? Anybody want any more details or wants to talk about it more, feel free to ask me about it. Trademarks, I get this. Again, this is sort of a hodgepodge, so stop me if you have any questions. For most of you who are looking at this, some of you know this, some of you don't. Trademark is a brand name. It can be a word, a phrase, a symbol, a combination of things that specifically identifies your product. You don't have to have a federal registration to use a trade name. You can use a name until someone tells you to stop. And then it becomes a priority of rights. Use your name, give me a name. Can't be your last name. Right. that's one of the rules. Give me an example of a brand name that y'all are thinking about. Caprice. So you could use. There could be a Caprice Winery in Oregon. You could use Caprice for 25, 30, 40, 50 years. You could become the most famous winery. Your Caprice could be the most famous ever. And you could have never registered federally. The reason to register your trademark is to give yourself a priority of rights. That gives you a better ability to enforce your right, and it means that if anybody else had a prior use but didn't register it, you've got the priority. But if they had registered it and they just decided one day they didn't like you using it and they told you to stop and you didn't, they would have a better claim at the end of the day to make you stop using it. When you pick a name, you need to consider about whether or not it's registerable. And then there's the practical question of how strong is it and how easy is it to protect? Because it may be registerable, but it may be almost impossible to enforce. Things to think about in particular, what they think about at the office when you go to register is likelihood of confusion with other marks. It can't sound like it can't look like it, it can't make somebody believe that it would come from the same source. It's a relatively subjective determination by the trademark officer that looks at it. And so the first thing I would suggest you do is get on Google and run a search using your name and wine. And just see if there's anything else out there that's even close. And then you can do some more detailed searches on these websites, both in Argentina and in the U.S. Everything I've told you up to now is all about the U.S. I'll come back to Argentina in a minute and what I think you need to do there. When you do your search on the web, when you go looking to do this, think too about foreign equivalents. Recuerdo, memory. If there's a memory wine, you could have a problem. One way around that when you make your application, you get to tell them what the translation is. So recuerdo could also be memento. So think about, so if you see a foreign equivalent of one of the translations, if you have a foreign name, and it's going to have to be a foreign use of a regular language that somebody would be able to tell was the same also. We have some people using Quechua. I wouldn't worry about the foreign equivalent of that. Other things to think about. So that's likelihood of confusion with other marks. Other things to think about are the easiest and most obvious way to get a unique name that no one else is going to be able to, are called fanciful or arbitrary. Fanciful are invented words. Arnaldo Rodriguez used his son's nickname, for example. He's not. That's going to be one of the easiest and most protectable types of marks. Arbitrary marks are words with a known meaning that have no association with the goods protected.
Okay, do you have an idea for cost associated with it?
Yep. Let's just blow through this. Generic marks, you can't call your wine wine. That's not a registrable mark. Descriptive marks, I can't think of one at the moment. World's best bagel, world's best wine, not likely to be markable. And if it is, hard to protect.
I just wanted to comment on using your surname. You can do that. It has to be put on the secondary register. You have to wait 5 years. And at that point, you can apply for it to be put on the primary register of the Dutch Brand. And you can then request to be on the primary register. And I submitted mine 5 years ago, so now I can go and apply to be on the primary register.
How cool is that? Mm-hmm. How cool is that?
And frankly, I just did it online.
Yeah, it's not,
simple.
It's not.
You don't have a really complicated design.
Exactly. General costs are here. These are quotes that we use with our lawyers at Graham & Dunn. $650 to do a conclusive search. You can search online, but everything you find is going to be instructive, not dispositive. And then the actual trademark filings run from about $2,800 to $3,700 if there are no objections. If you need to do an appeal or something like that, that would cost you more. Filing fee is $325 per class. There are different classes that you can register in. Alcoholic beverages, or was it just wine?
It's international class 33 for wine.
Okay. There you go. See?
Excuse me. Is there the annual cost also associated with the
No, it's one time. It's a one-time thing. Once you get, and then once you're approved, once it's registered, you can start using the trademark sign, and you then own that mark. Again, that doesn't mean that someone else can't use it. That's why the burden is on you to be vigilant about stopping people from using any mark that you're aware of that is the same or is substantial, leads to a likelihood of confusion. About 14 months from start to finish. Ours was faster than that, though, like way faster. 9 months?
Probably.
So it depends, I'm sure that. And I'm happy to refer you to the guys we use in the U.S. They're amazing, not to mention interesting. Our trademark lawyer wrote the liner notes for 2001 Space Odyssey CD. So let me go back really quickly to Argentina. So that's your U.S. issues, right? In Argentina, in order to export and use that name only for export, you only have to show that you've started the registration process in the United States, or you register, and or you have to register that name with the INAV, which is the Instituto Nacional de Vinicultura, something like that. It's the wine regulatory agency for the province of Mendoza. They have, or is it national?
National.
They then register that name at the INAV. That does not provide any proper intellectual property protection. But what it does is allows you to export, and what they're supposed to do is make sure no one else is exporting wine with that same name. There is another entity, which is the equivalent of the patent office, the trademark office for in Argentina, called INPI. There you can go and try to register your brand. We're going to recommend that you guys do this. We've got a lawyer who will do it for us. It is not necessary in order to export, but if you don't do it, our concern is that someone else will pick up that name, and at some point they will attempt to block your exportation. Theoretically, they shouldn't be able to do that, but I find that Argentine agencies, just like the ones here, are not particularly flexible, creative, or intelligent. So even if you show them that it's going for export, it's not being used internally, that there should be they shouldn't have the authority to do it, but as soon as it goes as a block, then we're in the situation of having to really think about it. If you're importing for your own personal consumption and you're not trying to create a brand, it's not a big deal, but you don't want to put a bunch of time, money, and energy into making a brand and then have a block happen in Argentina. The issue is that in Argentina, a lot of people have a lot of names. If yours is anywhere close to it, unlike in the United States where we think of substantial likelihood of confusion is a kind of a hard standard to meet, there, anything close, and they will tell you that you're going to have a problem, and so far we've seen that to be true. So when we filed for it, there is an objection. So as you're building your brands, if you're just now starting, let's go ahead and get both those things going, and let's make sure that we've got as much protection for y'all as possible. And quick questions about labels. Let's go back. Trademarks? Okay. Labels. You design your label. We can design your label. Anybody can design your label. I get the question all the time of who can print and where do we print the labels? And I hear this now more often than before, as the type of papers that we have available in Argentina, the choices have dwindled dramatically with the limitations on importations by our fabulous Christina. You can print them in the United States, but then I have a really hard time getting them into Argentina. So if you're gonna print them and you have enough of them that they're gonna go on a roll, or you're gonna, there's a ban against the importation of labels, that's why we don't have paper. So when you go to import it, it gets caught up in aduanas, it can be an absolute mess. Talk to John from Ravana, they shipped it down and it got caught in aduanas. We're trying to get it shipped back out. Even that, and it's been what, 6 months?
Can you hand bring them in?
If nobody catches you.
A few. If you've got 3,000 or 30,000, it becomes a lot more difficult.
Right.
Yeah, you probably. I mean, I've brought in TVs and we'll split it into three of us.
300 pages.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I don't think, I mean, and it's different if it's on a roll versus, you know, mixed in with a bunch of other papers. There are ways to bring them in if you want to do that. We're looking at solutions. We know this is an issue. We want to be able to give everybody the highest quality paper and lots of options. We're looking at temporary imports from Chile. We're looking at maybe being able to print in Chile. We're looking at being able to ship out with only a back label, so that you guys can then do front labels. We're looking at a bunch of options, but just want to make you guys aware that it's an issue. And don't rely on the fact that you can print your own labels and then ship them to us and we'll stick them on. I get the question all the time about the use
of... The shipping there is the main thing. Probably you're going to have a lot less problems if they're a reasonable number than when you bring them down.
Right. Yeah, no, it's shipping them down. If you can hand carry them, especially coming through Mendoza, I don't think they're going to care.
But your paper options are really limited today in Argentina. There's really like three papers. So if you have something specific in mind, or you've done something in the past and you want to match it, it really can be a challenge. It's another reason to get your labels done as soon as possible and work with the designers so that we can see samples and things like that to be able to talk to it.
But just FYI, other than the paper, because you guys sent me one sample, and our branding folks were super impressed with the quality.
It's good quality. There just aren't 50 choices. If you're in Napa, you could literally have 300 paper choices about your label. In Mendoza, you can have 3 or 4.
But not just the paper body, the work of the label.
Yeah.
I mean, just the sum total of the design. That's a kudos to your team.
Thank you. And printing them in Argentina is going to be less expensive, for sure. But again, if you want more options, then we need to get creative. But the really important thing, before you start, before you spend any money, before you let us know, so we can make sure that we're all on the same page. And if you're going to want to bring 3,000 in, that we figure out how you're going to do that before you spend the money to do it. And then we're like, ah, okay. So letting us know in advance, and we'll work with you on creative solutions to pretty much everything, but we just need to know. Using references to Santiago. If you think you want to use anything about Santiago on your label, you probably can't. He is the consulting winemaker for the project. His name doesn't go on anybody's labels, unless you come to some agreement specifically with him. So if you want to do that, you can talk to him about it. He is very selective about it. He doesn't do it generally. But Pablo Martabel is the winemaker for the vines. You guys can use his name. We will look at it, you know, make sure it's consistent with our interest as well as yours in terms of how you use it. But that's where we fall down on winemakers. You need to have your labels done now. Now, minimum, please, 6 months before we are going to ship. We ship generally twice a year, generally November, May. It all depends on when we bottle. It depends on a whole bunch of different things. A lot of it we'll talk about in how I get my wine and in distribution. We try to maximize containers. Most of you don't have enough to fill up a container, and as a result, it gets way more expensive. So we try to consolidate everybody together. If you guys are not finished with your labels, we can't submit it to TTB. TTB is now taking 60, 70, 80, sometimes 90 days for approval, even though their website says 30. And it varies. Sometimes it's 15 days, sometimes it's 45. If your label's not ready, and it's not approved by the TTB, I can't ship your wine. If I can't ship your wine and you are in a consolidated container, I can't ship anybody's wine. So getting your labels done doesn't just affect you. It really affects everybody, and it keeps everybody's cost low the more we can consolidate. And so it's kind of like herding cats, right? And that's why we're on y'all all the time, especially about this kind of thing. We also have to run it through the ENAVA. In addition, so when we consolidate the containers, we have to send samples to the ENAVA to match up alcohol contents. I mean, it is a long process. The fastest we can put everything together, if everything is ready from the time we bottle to the time we ship, 60 days.
If you've got a label approved and you're just changing vintages,
Casey, you can help me with this. Usually no, if it's just a vintage change. We talked about all that. So.
I think in California there's specific requirements on labels. One has to be on the front, back, and center. Do you have this here too?
Argentina does have requirements. They are not as specific about size, spacing, distance, that kind of thing. But there are things about, for a long time, and many of you know, we couldn't put Upo Valley on the labels. We have an issue about putting. A lot of you want to say that it didn't come from the vines of Mendoza. A lot of you want to say that it came from Shaken Family Vineyard.
I just have one quick warning about the ENAVA too. If they're starting to get a little bit stricter this year, so things that we could have passed before.
Can you speak up a little bit?
Sorry. Things that we could have passed before through the ENAVA, this year they're being really, really picky on and checking us a lot closely, so a lot more closely. So sometimes you say to me, hey, last year this wasn't a problem, but then I have to come back to you and say, well, this year it is a problem. And I don't really have like much of an explanation as to why it's a problem this year. It's just that this year they were checking it a lot more closely. And,
well, and remember that it's like, it's just like any bureaucracy. It comes down to the guy sitting at the desk looking at your file, right? So one, you know, you got one guy one year, you got another guy the next year. One thing's important to somebody one year, one thing's not important the next year. You know, we give you guys the information that we have at the time, and if it changes, it changes, you know? And so we have to be, just remember that those approvals have to get done and that they are not in our, they're not within our control. So the more time you can give us to work through the process, it's better for everybody. Okay, those are my, that's my hodgepodge of legal questions, of issues that I hear questions on. I sent out an email. I think I got to most everybody's questions. If I didn't, now's the time.
Talk about labels. Are there also limits on what style can be, Bible, the types, capital, reports, those things too?
No. And we have a label FAQ and a design package that is like this, and it gives you options for all of those things. It has the very specific things that need to go on the labels, all that kind of stuff that we can get you.
When you register trademarks in Argentina, do you handle that in-house? Do you use local attorneys?
We have local attorneys. But my feeling on this is that it is better handled through our legal office using the outside counsel. So we would do a pass-through. But I think probably managing for issues of language, for issues of timing, for all kinds of things, I think it's probably better if we manage the process for each of you, but we'll use an outside counsel in Buenos Aires. We've got quotes from him and that sort of thing. So I think it just is better. If we can manage it, micromanage it. Anybody else? Any other issues that I haven't talked about that you guys think about? I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be completely legal related, but anything that you don't know how it works in Argentina that I might be able to help with?
We get registered in the U.S. We're going to build a route registered in the U.S. registration first.
It depends on how attached to the name you are, right? I think it's harder to get I think the registration process in Argentina is more complicated. I think that the standard for likelihood of confusion is lower. So I think I'd run it through Argentina first and make sure you're not going to have a problem, even if it's sort of an informal touch base with the attorney and have him search the databases. Then you know whether you're likely to have a problem or not. And if you're not, then you can go ahead with both at the same time.
What's the you got an estimate of cost for Argentina?
$1,500. I think it was about $1,500.
For the whole thing or for the search and then the...
For the whole thing. For the search and the registration. Assuming no oppositions and all that other stuff. Okay, now the fun gets to start. Yay. Now we've got taxes.
Good job, Effie.
Sorry. Close this right.
Okay, so first as a disclaimer, I am an attorney and I'm not an accountant, so I actually went to law school because I did not want to take the GMAT and go to business school because I hate math, so it's funny and it's just kind of interesting that I got so involved in helping with our clients' taxes, and it's kind of a love-hate relationship now because I feel like I can do your taxes in Argentina if I had to. Luckily, we have outside accountants who do them for us. But it's something that I did not think I was going to learn 3 years ago when I started with Devise. So we're going to try to make this as painless as possible for you all.
And fun.
And fun. Hopefully. Okay, so first question we get, and so we have owners here who have been owners of the Vines since 2007, and we have people who have become owners in 2013. And so I know that there are some of you that have been paying taxes since 2007, and some of you haven't even filed yet. So this is kind of be a more broad overview of the taxes. Oh, sorry. Sorry, can you all hear me now? Better back there? Okay. So the first question we get is, what taxes do I have to pay in Argentina? There are several. The first one is property tax. We're putting the Spanish names in parentheses for you so you can impress people at cocktail parties, because obviously talking about taxes at cocktail parties is fun. So that's the impuesto inmobiliario, which is really hard to say. Then we have the minimum presumed income tax. That is called the ganancia minima presunta. Then we have income tax, which is ganancias, which is pretty easy. And then we have a personal asset tax, which is bienes personales. So here are the general questions we get and the answers that I would give you if we were having a conversation. So when do I start paying taxes? It would be immediately. The first year that you make a payment to us is when you start paying taxes.
Even if I don't have title?
Even if you don't have title.
Even if I haven't finished paying for my vineyard?
Even if you haven't finished paying for your vineyard.
Even...
Stop it.
Done. You gotta pay now. I'm jumping in. This ties to the security zone issue. The reason nobody is in a big hurry about the security zone, even the taxing authority considers you an owner of your land and taxes you on land that you don't own yet because they haven't approved you to own it. It gives you an idea of generally what we're dealing with on the bureaucratic side. They're not in a hurry. I mean, they're getting taxes, they're getting tax revenue. Why do you care? So anyway, sorry, I'm frustrated by that. Okay.
Okay, so property tax. We're gonna start with the probably most straightforward one. This is the tax levied on property. So, for example, you own a house. I have a place I own in Austin. I get a tax bill from the county tax assessor saying how much I owe, and I pay it. And it's simple as that. So how much is it? And it's actually a very small amount, which is great news. So it's about $20 per year, per lot. Doesn't matter the size of your property, which is really cool. And how does it get paid? The Vines actually pays that for you because it's such a small amount, we're not gonna bug you with that. And what we do is we include it in your maintenance budget or true up for the year. Okay, now we're getting into sort of deeper stuff. So please stay with me.
Sort of?
Okay, so the minimum presumed income tax, also known as the ganancia minimum presunta, what is it? So it's an asset tax. And the reason why this is the way it is because AFIP realizes, which AFIP is the Argentine IRS, they realize people don't want to pay taxes, they'll do anything to not pay taxes. So this is their way of getting you to pay tax on something that you might not even own yet.
So well, then they get you to pay tax in advance of when you're actually going to owe it. And then they use those as credits, which she's gonna get into, but it's a clever way of sort of getting some money in the bank early on so that when people don't pay their taxes later, there's something already collected.
But the good thing about this is that, and so if you mentioned you get credits that you can build up for use in the next 10 years when you start generating income, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But how much is this tax? So this tax is 1% of the total price of your vineyard, which is the land and services amounts that you paid when you bought your vineyard, less a standard deduction of 200,000 pesos. Okay, how does it get paid? And this I am very grateful for.
So it's not a fair market value thing, so as land goes up, you know, subject to the $200,000 is at time of transaction.
Right, exactly. It's the purchase price you paid for your vineyard, not the value of your land. We have English and Associates, who are our recommended accountants. You don't have to use them, but what you do is you hire an accountant. We'll recommend English and Associates, and we'll communicate with you. I'll get to that in a little bit. Almost all of our owners use English and Associates, with the exception of a few. But you're free to use whoever you want. And what happens is English and Associates files your taxes for you, in late April or early May, the deadline.
For the prior calendar year.
Right.
For the prior calendar year. So
it's like
just
in the
like
US. Exactly. And then usually the deadline moves, but it's usually around May 15th or so, just to give you an idea. What they'll do is they're going to invoice you, English and Associates or your accountant, will invoice you for their fees for preparing and presenting your filing, and also your tax liability that they're going to pass on to AFIP, which is the Argentine IRS.
You're
going to
get into all that.
So you're going to pay English and Associates, and they pay AFIP on your behalf. Okay, so here's a little timeline showing you how the process works in kind of a more fluid way. So what we do is, after we confirm that you're going to use English and Associates or your own accountants, what we do is we take all your invoices and gather them all and send them to whoever your chosen accountant will be. They're going to prepare your calculations for your review and send them to you so that you can review them and ask them questions about it. Either you approve it, you know, the first time because it looks like Greek and you say, okay, you're an accountant, that's great. Or you can ask questions if you have an accounting background or you really care, which is
Conrad
a
Johnson.
Good thing. Yeah. I'm looking at you, Conrad. And you get to a final version that you approve. And so what they'll do is they'll file your taxes at AFIP, send you an invoice for your total amount, and you pay it, and they will pass along the money to AFIP on your behalf, and you'll get a receipt for payment. This is an actual photo of when I was collecting your invoices last year.
This is our high-tech approach to invoice gathering.
It requires the entire floor of the legal office, just so you know. So,
one quick thing on that. Michael talked about this in his opening, and we are investing this year in some software on the accounting side that is going to make it a lot easier for us to be able to offer you all a solution where you can access your invoices, your documents, your bills, your emails, those kinds of things that we send you in an effort to sort of reduce the email shuffle where you guys would have to go look for those things, and it will also hopefully put an end to this. Because we're going to need a bigger office.
Yes. Okay. So, this is kind of the confusing part. Your credits that you build by paying your minimum presumed income tax that you have for 10 years, are before you use those credits, are actually added back into your tax basis and are counted as an asset. And
okay, wait, think about that.
Yeah.
And that's why the question mark popped up.
Right.
You get a credit because you paid, then they, the next year, take that credit and drop it into your tax basis. Sounds crazy. I've had many, many conversations and arguments with them about this. Our accountants are convinced that this is correct. Any questions about that? Everyone gets that? Okay, because it really is a head scratcher for me. Right, that's the face that I have right there.
Yeah. So what happens if you sell it in 5 years? Do you lose the taxes you paid, or do you get money back?
I think
you never get money back. I can. That's an easy one. You never get money back.
And then the reason why they do treat this as an asset is because there are conflicting interpretations of the tax code. There is the actual tax code, and then there AFIP, the Argentine IRS, once again, issued an opinion about how to interpret the tax code, and they're kind of at odds with each other. So what English and Associates does is they take the more conservative approach, thinking, okay, well, you know, we're going to be conservative about this because, you know, at some point, if there's an audit or something else, you know, you want to show that you're being as conservative as possible and letting the Argentine.
But at the end of the day, it's up to you. So if you guys, you know, if you don't want to take this super conservative approach, the truth is it equates to a very small difference in your taxes. I think it was less than a couple hundred pesos, $100, something like that in difference. So it's up to you. You guys are, it's the same kind of accounting relationship that you have here. You guys are responsible for your accountants. You can make that decision, but it is something that may not ever have occurred to you because it seems crazy because it is.
Jackie?
Yes?
For the purposes of tax accounting, mm-hmm. do you know how they define income?
We're going to get to that.
Yeah, that's up next. Okay, so what happens when I sell grapes or wine? So during the first few years of owning your vineyard, when you're not having grape production for winemaking, for example, or you're not going to be selling your grapes because your vines are maturing, you're going to be filing and paying ganancia minima presunta, presumed income tax. So when you start selling grapes and wine, you're making sales, and so you're getting income, and so you are triggering the income tax filing. Everybody with me? Okay. Okay, so when you sell grapes or wine, the vines issues invoices and reports the sales to AFIP, because we have to, and these are known as a liquido producto. And here is an example of what a liquido producto looks like. It's very sexy.
I can't help but think about the funniness, the fact this is kind of like a pun, right? We're talking about wine and we're like issuing liquido productos.
So on there, it just it gives the quantity of grapes, the types of grapes you sold, who you sold it to, and how much the sale is for. So the vines, by law, has to retain a percentage of the total sale and pays it to AFIP. And this retention is actually goes into your tax account and can be used as a credit against your income taxes in the future.
And if it's unused, it carries over.
And for 10 years.
If we're just shipping this to our sales in the States, mm-hmm. it's outside.
Well, actually,
yes.
Exportation counts as a sale for tax purposes. So if you're having an export, then you would have made a sale in that year. And so you would need to file income taxes. But we'll talk about, you know, the difference between filing and paying, too, in a little bit. Because the good... But the good news is that you don't have to pay both. So, but we'll get to that. So anyway, so what is income tax? It is a tax on net income for the year. So how much is it? The rate is 35% of net income, which sounds crazy, but we'll get to that in a little bit because many of our owners, in my experience, and I've looked at all of the tax filings for everybody, I would say with the exception of one or two people, that most people have a net loss as far as taxes are concerned, so they don't need to worry about paying this.
Can I ask the why? So yesterday we saw statistics that the majority of folks are making wine for personal mm-hmm. consumption, only 6% of commercials. Is that driving that?
Yes. Yes.
So those 6% need to run for the hills?
Not even run for the hills, actually. And the good thing is because you've built up all these credits from paying minimum income, presumed minimum income tax.
No,
for
I opted
so many
out of
years.
That previously.
but that's really great, though, because you have all these credits in the system, so when it does come time to pay, it doesn't hurt as much. So. How does it get paid? English and Associates, or your accountant, files your income tax and your presumed income tax for each year.
Okay, wait, stop. Mm-hmm. This is another one of my RCA dog moments. Presumed income tax, in my opinion, would imply that that means there is no actual income tax. So when I started paying actual income tax, I would naturally assume that I would stop paying presumed income tax. Not true. It's Argentina. You only have to pay one of the two, but you have to file both, and you have to pay for the preparation and filing of both types of taxes every year, even if you actually have income and are going to pay actual income tax. Again, it was very hard for me to wrap my head around this. I want to make sure y'all understand it, because in the moment, it just seems completely illogical. Sorry. I'm the emphasis. I'm the color guy.
I appreciate my hype, man. So English and Associates bills you pay them, and they pay AFIP on your behalf. It's the same way that the ganancia minima presunta, presumed income tax filing, works in the way that you're communicating with English and Associates. They bill you, you pay them, they pay AFIP. Same deal. Okay, so how do they calculate the income tax? So your net income is your sales minus expenses. This is basic accounting 101. But the thing is not basic accounting 101, and it's not really intuitive, is what constitutes a sale. So a sale for you guys would be a grape sale. So say you sell your grapes to the vines or another vineyard owner or perhaps a third party, another vineyard project or whatever. So be that, and then nota liquido producto exportacion is just a fancy way to say your export invoice. export is a sale because you are actually selling your wine to an exporter. Then you have your expenses. So your expenses are your inventory, which is based on any wine that you have in production, prior year's maintenance. Basically, it's the value that they place on whatever inventory you have. Broker fees, if you sell your grapes to a third party who is not the vines and not another owner, there might be a broker fee. And amortization, so you actually begin to be able to amortize your initial investment in the vineyard and your services. So your services contract, your initial services contract, that amount can be amortized by dividing that by 33. And that's the amount of amortization that you can take for the year.
You got 15 minutes to see that.
Let's keep going. All right. So your net income tax due is your net income minus your losses for the past 5 years, which you get as credits. So if you're having, let's say you have 5 years that you have losses, and in year six, you have a gain, a net gain. In year six, you get to subtract all of the losses that you determined for the last 5 years to offset paying your income tax.
Times 35%.
Then you can subtract the credits that you've been paying into the system since you bought your vineyard by filing your minimum presumed income tax, minus the withholdings, which are the amounts that we retain when you make a grape sale that we have to report to AFIP on your liquido producto that we went over before, and that is your total tax due. So as you can see, if you have a net gain, you get all these things that you get to deduct from it, so in the end,
okay, but let's be specific. Right. It's not like a gift from the IRS. They paid for it, so it's not like, oh, good news.
Well, technically.
It's just like forced savings. I mean, okay.
Quick question, though, just because the expenses, I mean, this is a proxy income statement, because there's a bunch of expenses we have in the States that don't get put into them. I mean, so it's...
Right.
It's actually missing a lot of expenses that, so it's not a true, you're actually paying, it's inflating your income, I guess.
What expenses in the U.S. are you thinking of that you don't
get to? Oh, we have a bunch of branding, like we're paying, you know, marketing and branding and other things that we have going on in the States.
Printing the label,
you know, like we've got things that don't, they're not doing our accounting, that's not the IRS, right? Our business is in the U.S.
Right. We can look at and talk about what additional expenses can be don't we have an expenses page?
Yeah, when you get to the U.S.
We're gonna.
No, it doesn't come down to what revenue you have. There's an export fund that's effectively wholesale. If you're reselling it, it's like a revenue line, so you're gonna have to pay taxes in the U.S. anyway. You can get to deduct those expenses.
That's where I was headed. Yeah. So yes, and it's yes and no. Remember that. And this is important for when we get to the how you get your wine and distribution issues. You guys are wine producers below the Argentina. And if it's US above and Argentina below, you guys are producers. So as a producer, and when you export, you technically sell your wine. And you're done as the producer of wine. When it gets to the United States, you become the new owner of the wine. And then the sales and marketing and all that other stuff happens up here. It doesn't have anything to do with Argentina. So in some sense, it's not inflating because you're not getting income from the final sale, which is where we start talking about commercial solutions and that sort of thing on the other side.
The U.S. tax rates are actually higher anyways because you have state tax to put on top of it. So if you're making money doing this, you're probably better off paying whatever you can. US cost is a function of what you pay, including the tax that you pay on the surplus.
Yeah. Right. One comment here. As a wine producer, exporting wine without any business in the United States, the family cannot really wine, you can use your plane, tickets, your hotels when you do promotion as cost, your Argentine operation.
But
so
that's,
I think there's a lot of planning we
need to talk about. We need to talk about that a little bit because it's not the same because they're not bringing that income back to Argentina.
Right.
That's
right.
Staying in the United States. It's not the same. You understand what I'm saying? You can do that if you're in Argentina and you're bringing that money back to Argentina. If it stays in the U.S.,
when we do the export, money goes to Argentina. That all the export, right?
Well, if you sell the bottle to the distributor for $50 in the U.S., or a U.S. citizen, or a European, the producer component of it, you're not at the $30 yet, you're at 15. all of the expenses that you have against the 15 are at a lower rate. So you don't want to put as little expense there as you can. When you get to the States and you sell it for 30, you want as many expenses as you can, because in the States your effective tax rate is more like 45, yeah, not 35.
But what if you don't sell wine in the States? You just produce wine for your personal use.
If you're producing wine for your personal use, you're not getting a profit. Mm-hmm. So you have no issue in the U.S. You want as much of your expenses as possible.
So here's a question that you can clear out. So what's the transfer price? So
that's right.
So if the transfer price is our cost, then you're right, we'll never have a profit. The transfer price is $50 a bottle, then he's right, that's which right. is you want to push your expenses there. So what is the transfer price?
The transfer price is set at different, depending on the quality. Premium, super premium, or premium plus, super premium, and barrel fermented. And I think it's $6, $8, $10, and $12.
But the minimum you can put in the name.
But the reason for that is, and this is a balance, you have to, your export tax is based on your declared value. If you declare your entire value, your export tax is going to be really, really high. The downside is you're only insured up to your declared value. So there's a trade-off. Those are the numbers that we use. If you want to use other numbers, we can talk about them. Some people, you know, everybody's risk tolerance is a little bit different, but that's where we sort of draw the line to try to get us reasonable amount of coverage and insurance, but not pay ridiculous amounts in export taxes. Okay.
All right, let's move on, because I think
so.
All right.
It feels like double taxation, right? Because you've got minimum presuntas and you've got income tax.
So good news is that you never pay both income tax.
Well, just say it, because.
Okay, you never pay both net income tax and presumed income tax. You pay one or the other. You file both because you have to prove both amounts. You show both amounts because you make a sworn declaration to AFIP. But you only pay one of them. So, what if you have net loss? So, a net loss for the year means you only pay the minimum presumed income tax, because you don't you don't have any income on your ganancia statement. So, go to the next slide. What if you have a net gain? So, the net gain means you only pay the income tax, because you have an actual positive amount on your income tax. So, and you show them that. So, that's what you pay. So, personal asset tax. Sorry, we're speeding up a little bit, but. Personal asset tax is you only pay if you own or are constructing a house in Argentina. So there's some ambiguity over whether or not rural real estate is subject to this tax. English and Associates recommend that it is not. And the rate on the personal asset tax is 0.125%.
And let me be clear, it's not the only time that you pay those taxes. In y'all's situation, that's the most likely situation where you would be subject to that tax, is when you were constructing a house. There are lots of other instances where someone in Argentina might have to pay that tax, but
right. But as a foreigner who owns a vineyard, this is what.
That's an annual tax.
Yes. And so for assistance with Argentine taxes, because I'm not an accountant, we have Tatiana Lugones at English and Associates. That's her email, and we'll send you this presentation, so if you can't write it down now, we'll get it to you later.
And again, English Associates is great. We've been using them for a long time. We are talking about, and I would like some feedback from y'all about what you think about this. We have talked about the idea of bringing that work in-house. As you can tell, we do a lot of work on it. We're the ones that have the information and those kinds of things. We've talked about whether that is something that makes sense or doesn't. At the beginning, I'm the one who really wanted somebody on the outside, because I think it adds a layer of independence. On the other hand, I feel like we end up being really responsible for anything that happens with those filings, and we know more about what y'all's underlying asset is like and all the other stuff. We have all the documents. So think about it. If you get a chance during the conference to let me know what your initial reaction to that is, whether you'd be comfortable with us doing it in-house. I mean, we obviously have an accountant dedicated to it. Or if you prefer having an outside accountant doing it, I'd like to hear y'all's feedback about it.
Where are you?
In Mendoza.
Okay, so here's a quick overview of the U.S. issues and considerations for your U.S. taxes. So for tax purposes, vineyards and winemaking are considered two separate businesses. Vineyards are considered farming, and winemaking is considered manufacturing. So on request, we'll prepare and send you an itemized breakdown of your initial services payment to give to your accountants in the U.S., and they can figure out how to capitalize and start to depreciate, you know, those initial investment. So do I get credit for income taxes paid in Argentina in the U.S.? And the answer is yes. So for income taxes paid to a foreign government on a U.S. tax filing, a U.S. individual can choose to either take credit, and if you don't claim the full credit in a particular year, that can carry forward or it can carry back. And in the alternative, you can take an itemized deduction. Okay, can I deduct my travel expenses? This is probably the most frequent question I get from you all who are talking about your U.S. taxes. And the answer is maybe. It depends whether or not your vineyard, if you treat it, basically, it depends. Legitimate business expenses can be deductible so long as the expense is related to a business with a profit motive and not just a hobby. So that depends on your particular situation. If it is more like a business and you have a profit motive, the meals or entertainment expenses that you can deduct are limited to 50% of the total, and make sure you keep your receipts.
What Jackie's trying to say is that it comes down to your personal risk tolerance and tax approach. If you think you can, nobody is in this to not make money, right? Unless you want it, unless you're really not doing anything with it, or you're in a particular situation where your taxes are going to be very scrutinized or something like that. But that you're going to have to work out with your own tax person.
Okay, If your vineyard results in a loss, that loss can generally be used to reduce your income from other sources. However, there are three possible limitations on the use of those losses. There's the at-risk rules, the passive activity rules, or the hobby loss rules. And we can go over those together later if you have questions about them. I'm not going to go over them now, just for the sake of time. And so for assistance with U.S. taxes, we have an accountant. His name is Greg Hintz. There's his contact information. Again, we'll send it out to you later. But he's a pro for WEF. And that's it.
Okay, that's the presentation, but we were hoping to have time for Q&A. I know we're really tight. We have about 3 minutes, 5 minutes. So now's the time. I know a lot of you have been waiting to ask lots of questions, so.
You have multiple owners on the property, and one of them passes away. How does the estate planning go to the other two, if that's what's in the estate plan?
It depends on that. It depends on who those people are, what percentage of the overall estate the vineyard represents. If it's less than 20% of the overall estate, you can will it to whoever you want. Your will be the operative document. It gets probated in the United States. You would then domesticate that judgment in Argentina, and it would be reviewed to be sure that it complies with all of the Argentine hereditary laws. The one that is the most important is that you can't exclude your kids. But unless it's this 20% that's freely transferable.
So do we present anything in Argentina prior, or just have it in the will in the United States?
You just wait until it happens. And then you take that, you get a judgment on it out of the probate court, you get it domesticated in Argentina, and then they will review it for validity under Argentine laws. Wow, I sounded like a lawyer for a minute. We covered a lot of material. I don't know if there are specific areas that you guys need more concentration in or more information on, anything that left you feeling like the RCA dog.
You're going to talk in another session about what happens to the wine once it's exported. And,
That's coming up.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about it from the regulatory distribution side, not so much the financial side, in terms of taxes and that sort of thing, but I think it'll be obvious then what happens. I mean, I think a lot of...
But it's coming in at a very low declared value compared to its retail value. I have some questions about that.
Okay.
It might be helpful to follow up this just to present a few examples. So you have a 5-acre PPE, you're making a premium or super premium, you take a 2,000 and say it's your selling. If you can show what that might look like from tax perspective, because 90% of our owners are doing that. I think it would be helpful for them to understand if they actually do have an income tax liability or a presumed income tax liability. It might be helpful to just pick a few of the various scenarios. We know that you're not talking about it. A specific case, it's just a very generalized example, because I think what people are going to see is it's a very small.
We have a sample, but it doesn't have any numbers in it, right? A sample
right,
file.
It just shows you what goes into each line item.
We can do that.
Yeah. But yeah, we can absolutely do that.
Somebody write that down. You did?
Yep.
Okay, that's great.